This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. In 1967, James Earl Ray escaped a Missouri prison. He came from a St. Louis family and had led a life of crime. In 1968, a year after his jailbreak, America came to know him as a killer, the assassin of civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. Ray confessed to the killing and then later retracted that confession. He is still in prison for murder. But this summer, there came an unexpected release. The Trump administration unsealed more than 243,000 files from the FBI investigation into MLK's assassination, and that release started an unlikely chain of events that led filmmaker Nina Gildan-Seavey to a stunning revelation. Seavey is a St. Louis native and documentarian. She's been studying the MLK assassination for decades, and she's particularly interested in a theory about a conspiracy to kill the civil rights leader. At the center of that theory is a St. Louis criminal named Russell Byers.
I said, what do I got to do to make $250,000? He says, you got to kill Martin Luther King.
And that was the voice of Russell Byers talking to Nina Gildan-Seavey in August of this year, describing a $50,000 bounty for the murder of Martin Luther King. That wasn't the first time Byers had described the bounty. He told the same thing to the FBI. But in his interview with Seavey this summer, Russell Byers revealed something that he hadn't told the FBI, a seemingly minor detail that has reopened questions about an alleged conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, a plan that appears to have begun in St. Louis. Joining us now to talk about that is documentarian Nina Gildan-Seavey. Nina, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be here again.
So, Nina, you call Russell Byers the man who was supposed to kill Martin Luther King Jr. What do we know about what Byers was doing in St. Louis in the late 1960s?
So, Byers was a longtime, well-known criminal. He was a thief. He stole cars. He stole art. But you know, he was so good at being this criminal that he never served a day in jail. I mean, he was indicted many times, but he always got off. But in the meantime, he also, so he's sort of this high profile criminal. He was contacted by a buddy of his, a man named John Kaufman. And John Kaufman had a motel in Imperial, Missouri. And that hotel was a motel, was a place where he frequently stored his stolen goods and, you know, kind of just sort of, they did business together. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, Kaufman was all in it with him. And he said one day, he said to Byers, he says, do you want to make $50,000? And Byers says, well, what do I got to do? And so Kaufman says to him, well, meet me at 6:30 p.m. and we're going to go see a man. And that man was John Sutherland. Now, Imperial is just about 25, 30 minutes outside of St. Louis. And Sutherland was a well-known St. Louis patent lawyer, but he was also a diehard right-wing supporter of, you know, most of the right-wing causes, the White Citizens Council, the John Birch Society, so many of St. Louis's far right-wing causes and organizations. And the two of them, Kaufman and Byers, went to John Sutherland's house that night. And that's where the offer was made. Now, just a couple things. One is that Byers, who always said that he never wanted to deal drugs or kill people. And the reason he said that was because he thought that was the best way to end up in jail. But in that conversation that I had with him, he said this to the FBI. He also said this to the House Committee on Assassinations in 1978. He said, but he had a brother-in-law who was in the Missouri State Penitentiary who was serving a life sentence for having arranged a hit on somebody who was ultimately murdered. And that guy named John Spica, who was Russell Byers' brother-in-law, was serving time with James Earl Ray.
Mm-hmm.
That was just one of many, many connections.
Right. And we are going to talk more about this offer and the conversation that you had with Byers a little later in the show.
Okay.
But to get to James Earl Ray, whom you do discuss in your December 1st essay in Slate magazine, mm-hmm. Ray retracted his guilty plea to killing Martin Luther King Jr. and maintains mm-hmm. that there was a conspiracy, that bounty, the $50,000. Did Ray ever talk about this?
We're talking, so be specific, because there's James Earl Ray and there's also his brothers.
Oh yes,
John
so did
and
James
Jerry.
Did James so, Earl Ray himself, did he ever talk about the bounty?
So he didn't talk specifically about that bounty. He had this story that there was a guy named Raul who provided all of the money and who sort of backed, because here's, you know, James Earl Ray was on, like you said, was on the lam for like a year before he assassinated King.
Mm-hmm.
So he was living the life of Riley. He was, you know, going to Canada and Mexico, and he got a nose job, and he saw a therapist, and he was working for the George Wallace campaign, and he was taking dancing lessons, and he was a pornographer. He went to bartending school. He was really having a great time. And then in early sort of February, March, he leaves his home in Los Angeles. He was living in Los Angeles at the time. And he drives eastward to Atlanta and begins to stalk Martin Luther King. And he said a guy named Raul set him up to it. Well, nobody ever believed the Raul thing. That was clearly fictitious. But what it was, and the House Committee on Assassinations came to believe through many, many different pieces of evidence, that the people that James Earl Ray was covering for were his brothers,
mm-hmm.
John and Jerry, and specifically John, who owned a bar in South St. Louis called the Grapevine Tavern, which is down on Arsenal Street, was down on Arsenal Street. Building still exists. And it was out of that bar that the Byers bounty became sort of lore. I mean, you know, sort of a major offer. And you have to understand, $50,000 in 1968 was about $500,000 today.
Right. That's quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
And as far as the bounty, I mean, we mentioned earlier that in the summer, the Trump administration released about 250,000 pages of records related to Martin Luther King Jr., and you were interviewed about the release of these FBI files for a story that was in St. Louis Magazine.
Right.
And it was after that story came out that you received a message that, you know, led to this this unexpected chain of events that we mentioned earlier. Tell us, Nina, about getting that message.
So I get a lot of strange things, a lot of strange messages. It's not the first time. But this time I got this message from a guy I didn't know. And it says, the man who arranged for the, who brokered, that was the word that he used, brokered the assassination of King is still alive. Now, as you said in your intro, I've been studying this, you know, kind of this story for a very long time. And by the way, 250,000 pages of documents is not that much for people like me. that is just the tip of the iceberg. And believe me, there's a lot more to come.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter, so I got this email and I thought, you know, and I get a lot of these crazy emails and I usually just delete them and just throw them away. But this one, I was like, you know, this guy's talking about Russell Byers. And Byers was a guy I thought had been dead for a long time. And so I contacted this guy and I said to him, you know, listen, I'd like to talk to Russell Byers if he's still alive. And he says, sure enough. And I soon found myself on the phone with Russell Byers. And he was definitely alive, sort of at the end of his life. He was 93 years old at the time. He was just about to have surgery to lop off some small part of his body due to neuropathy. And so we made an arrangement to speak, which we did. And he agreed that I could record him in that conversation for what in my world is known as a pre-interview.
Mm-hmm.
Before I take a camera crew anywhere, I got to talk to somebody and I need to talk to them, you know, kind of, you know, have a good recollection. So I always record it and he agreed. And then And then he did something very strange, but not surprising.
And I think, yeah, I mean, as far as then talking with buyers at that point, very quickly, why did you want to talk to him?
Well, the buyer's bounty is not an unknown, you know, sort of phenomenon. And here's the thing, is I always try to caution people in the media and listen, including myself, sometimes I find myself slip, but it's not a theory. It's not a conspiracy theory. There are actual conspiracies in life.
Yes.
Right?
And we're actually going to, we'll pick up with that in just a moment.
Right.
This is St. Louis on the Air, St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Eileen Cha. Let's return to our conversation with documentary filmmaker and St. Louis native Nina Gildon-Seavey. Seavey is the author of a December 1st essay in Slate titled The Man Who Was Supposed to Kill Martin Luther King Jr. Now, Nina, before the break, we were talking about that man, Russell Byers, and his claim that he was offered $50,000 to kill Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. And in August, you had a chance to talk with Byers himself. And at this point, you know, he had already spoken to the FBI and he had made no secret about this offer. So what were you hoping to learn from him in August?
Well, I think I wasn't sure. I mean, you know, first of all, I'd always thought he was dead. So it was news to me that he was still alive. And so what I did what, you know, all good, you know, sort of documentarians do, is I started at the beginning and I was worried about his, you know, how compos mentis he was. I mean, he was, you know, 94 years old. He'd lived a really, really tough life as a criminal. But, you know, the more I talked to him, the more his story was, you know, he had very, very good recall. Like you hear, like you heard in your intro, you know, he had like that gravelly voice of an old guy. But, you know, he was, you know, he wasn't confused at all.
Mm.
And I pressed him a number of times on various things to make sure that, you know, his recollection was, you know, fit with what I know the record was, because I've seen these FBI documents. I've read everything about him from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I mean, he testified before the committee for several hours in both a closed session and an open session. And the open session materials obviously are, you know, on the record. But then he did something that took me by surprise. And I don't know if you want to talk about that now or you want to keep that a little bit for a bit and for later.
Well, before we get to that, though, Nina, okay. You were making a point about the conspiracy to assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. not being mm-hmm. a conspiracy.
Not what? Being a theory.
Not being a theory. Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Not being a theory.
Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
There are conspiracies that are true. And, you know, it takes a lot to make a conspiracy. One thing it takes is that not many people can know about it. And this was certainly the case here. Now, Russell Byers, according to his testimony before the House, I'm going to say HISCA, which is House Select Committee on Assassinations, HISCA, and his reporting to the FBI, had told only a few people about the bounty offer. He told his attorney, his first attorney, a guy named Murray Randall, who ultimately became a judge. He told his Jeffrey Crouppen, who was his second attorney, Wienick, rather. He told them. And he told a confidential informant in 1973. Somebody he didn't know who was a confidential informant to the FBI, but he told that individual, and that's documented in the FBI record.
Mm-hmm.
So all we know is that there was only three people who knew about it. And all of those people knew about it after the assassination.
And that actually gets to this thing that we've been teasing about what Russell
yes.
Byers told you. And, you know, it was not anything new, but it changes the timeline of this bounty that's named after him. So take us into that moment, Nina, and why the timeline is so significant to this conspiracy, which is not a theory.
Right. So the House Select Committee on Assassinations developed four potential ways that the Byers bounty could have gone from the Grapevine Tavern, from Russell Byers to the Grapevine Tavern, to the Missouri State Penitentiary, where James Earl Ray was incarcerated before the time that he escaped. And all of those, now you have to understand, it was headed by a guy named Robert Blakey. Blakey was at the time probably the best known criminal prosecutor in America. He wrote the RICO statutes against the mob, and he was the chief investigator for the House Select Committee. He found what was called a link analysis that connected the Grapevine Tavern to the Missouri State Penitentiary and to James Earl Ray. But it was always slightly more circumstantial because Russell Byers said he never told anybody about the bounty until after King was dead. So when I'm talking to him and we're going through this, recitation of what happened to him, he said to me about 5 minutes after I left Imperial, I went down to Maryland Avenue to an antique store where I was working with a buddy who, they were trading in stolen lamps. And I told him about the bounty. And I was like, wait a minute. No. I said, you testified before the House Committee on Assassinations that you told you didn't tell anybody about the bounty until after King was dead. And he said, do you understand what I'm telling you? It wasn't 5 years after the bounty was made, the bounty offer. It was 5 minutes. Now, obviously, it wasn't exactly 5 minutes because it takes 25 minutes to get from Imperial to St. Louis. But the fact is, the change in timing meant that the conclusion of the House Select Committee on Assassinations was more valid than anybody has ever thought. And it gives credence to the fact that James Earl Ray was connected through the Grapevine Tavern, through the brother-in-law, John Spica, who I mentioned before, who was in the slammer for his contract hit, who was a connection, who was a cellmate of James Earl Ray. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many connections. I'm not going to go into them all because I gotta make your audience just go blurry eyed. Right. but the connections that the House Select Committee on Assassinations and that Robert Blakey made were so tight, but they were all predicated and somewhat conditional on the fact that Russell Byers had not told anybody until after the assassination. Mm-hmm. And indeed, he confessed to me that he told people about the Byers bounty, what we call now the Byers bounty, immediately after the bounty offer was made.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nina, earlier in our show, we listened to a bit of your August interview with Russell Byers, and he described getting the offer to kill MLK for $50,000. And his response at first was that he would consider it.
I was afraid if I said no, I wouldn't leave him. So I said, okay, let me think about it. When I got outside of the coffin, I says, what, are you crazy or something? They don't kill people. He says, well, you've got a brother-in-law that does. I says, well, that's the way it goes. I don't kill people. So we left it going down.
Now, that audio is a little hard to make out. And what he says there is that I was afraid if I said no, I wouldn't leave here. So I said, okay, let me think about it. When I got outside, you're crazy or something. I mean, what he's telling you there, what stood out to you about this description? You know, is Byers saying that he actually you know, was thinking about taking this offer up and then backtracked because, you know, as he says, that he doesn't kill people?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, and you know, you extend that just a little bit further, you know, that in that interview, he says, well, you have a brother-in-law who does.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's what he's saying is that we know you might not do it, but you could arrange to have it done, which is why when I got that that email, he said,
oh, right,
the man who brokered the assassination of King. So, and he was afraid of John Sutherland. He was, you know, he walked into Sutherland's home and Sutherland had this, you know, kind of Confederate cap on. He walked into the house. It was full of all of this rebel paraphernalia and Confederate flags and, you know, swords. And, you know, this man was living in the antebellum era and the antebellum period. So he was worried if he said no right out, he might not get out of there alive. So he said he... And he told the committee he crawfished a little, meaning that he sort of sidled to the side a little bit. And he said, let me think about it. And they didn't care whether he did it himself or whether he arranged to have it done. But this was a man in St. Louis who was probably the prime number one candidate if you wanted to have a major public murder of a you know, of a national figure. Russell Byers was the man to go to.
Mm-hmm. And as a reminder, John Sutherland was a patent attorney in St. Louis who, according to Russell Byers, had made that offer to pay $50,000 to assassinate King. Nina, what happened to John Sutherland?
So John Sutherland, you know, ultimately passed away, as did John Kaufman, and that became a bit of an issue for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, because by the time the committee met, which was, you know, 77, 78, they had already passed away. James Earl Ray was still alive. John and Jerry Ray were still alive. Russell Byers was obviously still alive. There were many people who are still alive, but James Earl Ray was sticking to his Raoul story because there was no way that he was going to implicate his family. So, you know, but nobody ever believed that story. And when the House Select Committee came out with their report, it relied on the Byers Bounty and the link analysis that Robert Blakey had done to prove that, in fact, there was this conspiracy inside the Grapevine Tavern in St. Louis among the Ray family, who the FBI, by the way, never investigated as a potential co-conspirator. And so for some unknown reason, I mean, well, there are reasons why they didn't do it. I'm not going to, again, go into it. But the FBI intentionally fell down on the job. And intentionally didn't investigate that conspiracy. So you had sort of a meeting of all of perfect storm, if you will, of FBI inaction and the willingness of Russell Byers to lie to the House Committee on Assassinations and for James Earl Ray to never, ever give up his family.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, you know, many of the links that you're talking about as far as the link analysis, I mean, one of the other links is one location, and it is that Grapevine Bar in St. Louis. The bar does not exist anymore, but the structure is still there in Benton Park. And this was a bar that was run by the brother of James Earl Ray. Talk to us a little bit more about this bar and its connection to your source, to Russell Byers.
So the Grapevine Tavern was sort of one of these quintessential sort of dive bars. First of all, John Ray was himself a convicted felon. And so he actually couldn't get a liquor license. So he got his sister, Carol Ray Pepper, to get the license for him. He wanted to open this bar. And so it was really owned by John and Carol, James Earl Ray's siblings. And it was sort of known. It opened in early 1968, late 1967, early 1968, as a place where you could, you know, kind of pick up a, you know, your latest heist job, and you know, find out what was going on in the criminal right wing underworld. It was George Wallace for President campaign headquarters was just down the street. The South St. Louis police sort of would come in and put George Wallace pamphlets down on the bar. You could kind of find out, you know, what was going on in the criminal underworld.
And that was also... I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to take that up after we take a very quick break. We'll continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. We're talking today about new evidence in the assassination of Martin Luther King. I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker and St. Louis native Nina Gildon Seavey. Seavey is the author of a December 1st essay in Slate titled The Man Who Was Supposed to Kill Martin Luther King Jr. Nina, you interviewed Byers shortly before he died in October, and he revealed that he spoke about a $50,000 bounty before the killing of Martin Luther King, which is not what he testified to the FBI. And he told you that, in fact, he revealed this bounty immediately after hearing about it. So, I mean, this has a lot of implications, and it raises questions about the FBI, and Byers told you that the FBI, quote, should have acted upon it. He would still be alive, he being MLK. Do you think he's right, Nina?
Well, obviously, we can't know what we don't know, right? But here's the thing, is that the FBI did know. There is now more hard and solid evidence that the FBI knew that King was going to be killed. And you have to understand, I mean, this was at a time when J. Edgar Hoover had what was, I mean, we could actually call an obsession with King. He hated him. He called him the biggest liar in America. He targeted him through a super, super top secret program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. He bugged his hotel rooms. He sent him sex tapes that he said he was going to release to the public of King having these affairs. And I mean, the level of subversion that J. Edgar Hoover engaged with against Martin Luther King is now well known, obviously. But the bottom line is that they knew and they failed to act. There's a lot, you know, there were people who felt, and certainly in the FBI, and as you know, there's I didn't just write that one article, but I did a podcast called My Fugitive. And it's about St. Louis in the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, the FBI basically, when King was assassinated, said, well, he was no good anyway. So they were not sorry to see him go. Mm-hmm. So so the idea that somehow they were going to investigate any conspiracy to kill King when it might reveal their own unlawful activities was certainly not going to happen.
And you wrote, Nina, quote, the agency's failure to investigate a conspiracy to kill King could have been one of the most fateful errors of inaction in the history of our nation. Yeah. What do you mean by that phrase, by a fateful action, a fateful error of inaction?
Well, you know, it's, you know, sometimes it's what you do and sometimes it's what you don't do that matters. In every investigation, there is always three parts to an investigation. There's a shooter investigation. Who did it? There's a fugitive investigation. Where is the person who did it? And the third is a conspiracy investigation. Who helped that individual? And it was that third tranche of what J. Edgar Hoover knew and did in every other criminal proceeding that the FBI was involved in the 50 years that that man led the agency. He didn't do it in the case of James Earl Ray and the assassination of King. And again, there's some pretty complicated reasons that I go into more into my fugitive, also into other things that I've written, and then also in the Slate article. But we are, and this now this is ongoing, because this notion of it, of what we don't know, and again, those 250,000 pages of documents is just a drop in the bucket, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions of pages still yet to be released. There are tapes, there are memoranda, and there is the entirety of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, their closed sessions, their depositions. Everything. James Earl Ray testified in closed session as well as in open session. Jerry Ray testified without an attorney for 2 solid days in closed session. None of that has been made public yet. Mm-hmm.
Is that part of what you would like to see? And what
no
other records?
About.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, and look, people like me, we are now using AI to be able to comb through this material much more quickly. If you saw the room in which I'm sitting to do this interview, it is lined with binders of documents that have been, you know, 130,000 pages used alone in My Fugitive, which again goes, you know, has some to do with in episode 7 and 8 of this assassination to kill King, and other documents that we have found. And all of it is located in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I can stress enough how much of an epicenter, a crucible St. Louis became. And again, for a variety of reasons, it became a real hotbed down on Arsenal Street, specifically at the Grapevine Tavern. It became a crucible for the right wing criminal underworld.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you're talking with Russell Byers, the way that you were made aware that he was in fact alive and not deceased, as you had thought for a long time. I mean, he mm-hmm. was still here in the St. Louis area in Creve Coeur.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything you wish that you had time to ask him?
Well, you know, I did a pretty thorough interview with him. You know, I'm always thinking, oh my gosh, I wish I had, you know, like this little detail. But, you know, to be honest, those, you know, that is so, you know, it's so granular, the things that I'm interested in. And to be honest, I would really rather see them in the documents. I think for me, the revelation that he had lied to the committee, that he had no compunction to tell the truth to the committee, that, you know, and look, I understand he did not want to go to jail. And if he told everybody who was in authority that he had not said anything until after the assassination, then he was in the clear. And so that was his story. And at the age of 93, and then he turned 94 during the time that he and I were kind of talking to each other, he was ready to tell me the truth about when he actually spoke about the Byers bounty, which then obviously implicated him and the Grapevine Tavern and many people in that circle in the assassination to kill King.
Mm-hmm. Nina, you and other researchers like David Cunningham over at Washington University, you're studying
yeah.
St. Louis during this time period, including the FBI's activity tracking anti-war groups and also the movements of white supremacist groups. What about this time period fascinates you? You know, you've described the room that you're in, how full it is of material. What are you hoping to understand about it?
Well, you know, first of all, I think stories about the Midwest are woefully underreported. And so for me, you know, again, I haven't lived in St. Louis since 1978. I went to University City High School. That's always the question. Where'd you go to high school?
Right.
I went to Washington University, graduated from there with a degree in history and French literature. And, you know, but I haven't lived in St. Louis, but I am a storyteller. And I will go wherever, however, to whatever lengths I have to in order to tell a great story. And I feel like these stories about St. Louis in what was a very formulative time in the Midwest in terms of its political incarnation. What led to Ferguson? What led, to, kind of a lot of the, the controversies that we see today? All of those are very, very firmly embedded in a transformation out of the 1950s into the 60s and 70s in St. Louis. And I think we learn a lot. I'm also a historian, so I love the past and the stories that they bring, but I think they really help us to understand the present. And specifically, I feel like the King family and America needs to know what happened in the King assassination.
Nina, the Trump administration's release of these files on the Martin Luther King assassination, it happened under some specific circumstances, and it was under pressure to release information on the case of Jeffrey Epstein. Now, the Trump administration has not been like other administrations. The president does things, in his way. Do you think that he will release any more of these files?
And I think, the operative concept there is in his way. I don't think we ever know what he's going to do. And so, I fear that there, and I sense and dealing with the National Archives and the Senate Historical Office and some of the other official organizations, the agencies that deal with the release of these files, it's not clear that they know. As I said, 250,000 pages is just not that much. And whether or not the Hiska files in particular, and all of that testimony and all of those depositions, if that, I mean, is Trump going to release that? I think it's a coin toss. I think if he feels pressure about the Epstein files, he might well, give up, cough up a little bit more. But there's no rhyme or reason to it. And that is very problematic in trying to understand and make sense and really in that sense lay a foundation, a criminal foundation for the assassination of the nation's leading civil rights icon. That's mind-boggling. And we're going to leave it up to chance. I'm not in favor of that.
In our last few moments here, Nina, Byers speaking to you, I've wondered about what motivated him, and he actually made you an offer. What does that show you about Byers? I mean, does that make him more or less trustworthy? He was a lifelong criminal. I mean, how do we understand this?
Yeah, I mean, he tried to shake me down for $75,000. He said, "Okay, you come to my house and, I'll let you film me for $75,000." And I tried to explain to him that, journalists do not pay for their, for their interviews, and, trying to reason with a, like a lifelong criminal is not an easy thing to do, his notion of ethics being different than my own. But I think he had no, in that sense, there was no reason for him to tell me what he told me. He had an official story. That official story was something he was willing to give up in the sense that he was willing to tell me the true story. He knew he was going to die. He was 94 years old. He was being chopped up for parts by the time I got to him. And so, but did he, was he going to try to do what he, to me, what he did to everybody else? I mean, his own attorney said, back in the day that he was the most dangerous criminal in St. Louis. And if your own attorney says that about you, you gotta, that means you're a pretty bad dude. But I don't think it, there was no reason for him to tell me the truth. He had a story. And then he said, "Do you understand what I'm telling you?" And I was like, "Yes, I do."
Oh,
And
Nina,
that was profound.
We'll be looking forward to what else you uncover. Please stay in touch with us. Nina Gildenseevy is a St. Louis native, documentary filmmaker, and the author of a December 1st essay in Slate titled The Man Who Was Supposed to Kill Martin Luther King Jr. Nina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. And everybody donate to St. Louis Public Radio. It's the best.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.